something happening here. But what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is a debate on state surveillance. Former CIA and NSA Director Michael Hayden and Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz argue in favor of the resolution. Be it resolved, state surveillance is a legitimate defense of our freedoms. Journalist Glenn Greenwald and Reddit co-founder Alexei Bohannon argue against the resolution. Team opposed to the resolution won with a 13% vote gain.
Next, former NSA Director Michael Hayden and journalist Glenn Greenwald debate whether state surveillance is a legitimate defense of freedom. They're joined by Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz and Reddit co-founder Alexis Ohanian. This is part of Toronto's biannual Monk debate. It also includes tape remarks by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden.
Welcome to this extraordinary debate on state surveillance. My name is Rudyard Griffiths. It's my privilege to act as the organizer of this semiannual series and to once again serve as your moderator. Speaking first for the motion, be it resolved, state surveillance is a legitimate defense of our freedoms, is acclaimed trial lawyer, Harvard scholar, and storied civil libertarian. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Alan Dershowitz. Joining Professor Dershowitz on the pro side of tonight's contest is none other than the former head of the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the former head of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's a retired four-star U.S. general. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Hayden. Now, one great team of debaters deserves another, and we have not let you down tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome serial technology entrepreneur, the co-founder of the global social news phenomenon Reddit, and best-selling author, Alexis Ohanian. Alexis. Alexis's partner tonight is a person who's been at the very center of this global debate since Edward Snowden stunned the world last June with his unprecedented leak, his exposure of America's most intimate cyber espionage programs. In the ensuing year, Our presenter has become, in the words of the Financial Times of London, the most famous journalist of his generation. Ladies and gentlemen, First Look Media's Glenn Greenwald. Before we call on our debaters for their opening statements, I need the help of everyone in this hall and those of you watching at home with three simple tasks. First, and you don't often say this in a gracious concert hall like this, power up your smartphones. We have an open Wi-Fi network broadcasting throughout the hall. You can tweet to our hashtag, #MonkDebate. Also, we've got a rolling opinion survey of the audience tonight. That's both for you in the hall and for those of you watching online. Pop open your browser, enter the URL, www.monkdebates.com/vote. And third, this is important, those of you in the hall, when you see our dastardly countdown clock appear on the screens at the end of the allotted time for opening statements, rebuttals, and closing statements, please join me in a round of applause for our speaker. This is going to keep them on their toes and, of course, our debate on time. One last thing before we get to opening statements. Let's find out how all of you, the 2,500 of you, voted at the outset of this evening's debate on our resolution, be it resolved, state surveillance is a legitimate defense of our freedoms. Let's have those results now, our opening vote. 32% agree, 74% disagree, 47% disagree, 21% undecided. So a debate in play. Now, a very important question, because what these debates are all about is which one of these teams can sway public opinion, who can change the minds of the 2,500 people in this hall over the next hour and a half. So who is open to changing their vote? What percentage? Let's have those numbers. Wow, 87% of the audience gathered here, a very open-minded crowd. Only 13% of you are committed resolutely to the pro or the con side. A great set of results to kick off our opening statements, which I'm going to do now. As per convention, the pro side will speak first. 6 minutes for each opening remark. General Hayden, the floor is yours.
Well, good evening, and thanks for coming. And thanks for the warm welcome. After I read your morning newspaper and saw that Alan and I were identified as two of the most pernicious human beings on the planet, I just wasn't really sure. State surveillance is a legitimate defense of our freedoms. Well, we all know the answer to that. It depends. And it depends on facts. It depends on the totality of circumstances in which we find ourselves. What kind of surveillance? For what kind of purposes? In what kind of state of danger? And that's why facts matter. Okay? But in having this debate, in trying to decide whether this surveillance is a legitimate defense of our freedom, we really need to know exactly what this surveillance is. And I freely admit, that's hard. Okay? This stuff has been pushed out into the public domain, and you've had a chance to look at it, and sometimes it's been pushed out there in a way that, well, let me be kind, it's not clear. And other times it's been put out there in a way that's just wrong. Let me give you an example. And by the way, you know, no one has to have ill intent to make it wrong. This is actually really complicated stuff. There is one slide that was pushed out in the public domain over a program called Boundless Informant. If I were actually thinking of names that would eventually become public, that's probably not one I would pick, okay? But what it was a heat map of the world. And it showed the metadata events that NSA, in one way or another, acquired in different parts of the world. And it cooked off tens of million metadata events that NSA was getting, according to the map, from France and Spain and Norway. And so immediately the story was, hey, these guys are ripping off the phone bills of a whole bunch of Europeans. The reality of the story was that the French, Spanish, or Norwegian services were providing NSA metadata that their services had collected, not in their own countries, but in internationally recognized theaters of armed conflict. It was a team ball effort, but it got rolled out as very aggressive a collection on the part of NSA. So it's hard, it's complicated. Sometimes, though, this stuff just gets rushed to the darkest corner of the room. All right? All ties go to the most ominous description of what's happening. And sometimes it doesn't even have to be a tie. It just goes to the most ominous description. Something called the PRISM program, that's the NSA having access through Google and Microsoft and Yahoo to materials on their servers in the United States, materials affiliated with a legitimate intelligence target. That got shoved out the door, that NSA is free-ranging on the servers of Google and Microsoft and Yahoo. That it just was an uncontrolled NSA exploration of this data. That's just not wrong. Now, that story was pushed out. The Washington Post was one of the ones who pushed it out. They corrected it on their website over several days without notifying people the article had been changed. But let's skip all that. Let's just all assume that we can get to hard truth, that we can actually boil this down to what CSEC's doing here and NSA is doing across the lake and GCHQ is doing in Great Britain and ASD is doing in Australia. Even then, you've got a problem. Because even then, you're walking into a movie theater late in the third reel, and you're looking at a scene, a snapshot of the third reel, and you're saying, "Aha! The butler did it!" Actually, you need to go back and look at the whole movie. You need to see what went on before. Because if you know what went on before, you may have a different interpretation of what it is you think the butler is guilty of. There are three or four things that happened that NSA and all these organizations have tried to solve. The one was volume. How do you conduct signals intelligence to keep you safe in a tsunami of global communications? Well, the answer to that is bulk collection of metadata. Another issue that's out there prominently is, you know, NSA is mucking about in those global telecommunication grids that have your emails. No one complained when NSA was doing Soviet Strategic Rocket Forces microwave signals. Well, the equivalent of those Soviet microwave signals are proliferator, terrorist, narco-trafficker, money launderer emails coexisting with yours and mine out there in Gmail. And if you want NSA to continue to do what it was doing, or CSEC to continue to do what it's doing, what it had been doing to keep you safe, it's got to be in the stream where your data is. There's a couple other things, too. After 9/11, the enemy was inside my country. That's the 215 program metadata. Who might be affiliated with terrorists inside the United States? And finally, when the enemy wasn't in my country, his communications were. It's an accident of history, but it's a fact. Most emails reside on servers in the United States. They should not deserve constitutional protection if the email is from a bad man in Pakistan communicating to a bad man in Yemen. And the prison program is what allowed us to get those emails to keep everyone safe. There's a lot more to talk about, but you're going to start clapping in about 9 seconds, so I'm going to go back to the podium. Thank you.
The command presence of a four-star general. It's bread in the bone.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes great speeches and interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., and you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, as well as at Facebook.
Alexis Ohanian, you are up next.
Hello, Canada. Thank you for being here. I know there's a basketball game going on, so I really applaud you. Now, we Americans and Canadians have a long history of shared values. Neither one of us wants to take responsibility for Bieber, but
that notwithstanding, one of those values is a right to privacy. It's something encoded in our governments and in our societies. It's something fundamental to who we are. We balance this with security. But the technological leap that we have made in the last couple of decades has enabled a surveillance state that goes at odds with these very fundamental rights. And the internet has made my career possible as an entrepreneur, as an investor. But it's also enabled a surveillance state that is simply unacceptable. You see, state surveillance is a threat to us for three reasons. It is a threat economically. It is a threat technologically to the very backbone of the internet. And finally, and somewhat paradoxically, it actually undermines security. It actually makes us more vulnerable. Let's talk about that. Both of our countries are huge draws for talent and money from all over the world because our tech sectors are leading the way. Right? It made my career possible. It's made so many others. Forrester, however, in light of our surveillance state, has estimated that the U.S. tech sector, the U.S. economy alone, stands to lose over $180 billion because now our global user base is thinking twice before signing up for our services. They're taking it to other servers where they know they still have that integrity. You see, I just got done visiting over 77 universities across the United States and Canada, even the University of Toronto and Waterloo. And I got to meet with founders who have every right to believe they can create the next Google. However, now their users are going to think twice about running that search query because they don't know which intelligence agency is using it. This is a real cost. There is national security in economic security, and that has been undermined by this mass surveillance. The NSA's insatiable appetite for data, it has polluted the network. And we're all online now, right? As citizens, as companies, as governments, we all share in this online network, but the very infrastructure, the technology behind it, has been threatened, and it's no longer healthy because of our brazenness. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, from a technological standpoint, the World Wide Web only works if it has worldwide in it, right? And now we hear countries like Germany and Brazil talking about balkanizing the internet. I'll tell you, Steve and I never could have started Reddit with the hope of it being a truly global platform if we thought that we didn't have access to actually anyone with an internet connection, right? The internet works because the more people that get on it, the better it gets. And this is the environment that we've created. You see, we're not just talking about law, we're talking about the very technology. We are keeping things insecure for the purposes of hopefully using it for surveillance somewhere down the road. Let me put it another way, all right? In layman's terms, it is as though law enforcement found out there was a flaw in every lock in every door in the city of Toronto, and they didn't tell anyone, they kept it safe, so that one day they could maybe use it to take advantage of some unsuspecting bad person. Now, the obvious problem with this is there's nothing stopping some other bad actor from taking advantage of that very flaw in the system. Except we're not just talking about the city of Toronto, we're talking about the world. And this is a reality right now. And this is simply unacceptable. A rising tide, when it comes to online security, a rising tide really does lift all boats, or secure all locks in this case. And this is something we are undermining by our actions. And it is done in the name of counterterrorism, but it's actually making us less secure. And that's a technological fact. Now, speaking of security, it's not that there's this trade-off that I'm talking about between privacy and security. I'm not talking about that trade-off. I'm talking about the trade-off between security that works, or security that does not work, and security that does. Instead of encouraging our government to leave these flaws open so that we can one day exploit them, we should be fixing them. Because if we were to invest even just a fraction of those dollars in making the network more secure, we would also be making our governments, our free societies, more secure. That brings me up to an interesting point. You see, I was lucky enough as a teenager to get my first modem. Changed my life. A dorky kid in suburban Maryland, I was able to get online, and it changed my life. It's made me the entrepreneur that I am today. It's allowed me to invest in over 100 companies that are hoping to do the same that Steve and I did with Reddit. But it's enabled so much good. It's also enabled so much bad. And that is where the surveillance state has gotten out of control. And that is the problem. Because you see, in the last century, technology and the laws gave us a certain amount of direct surveillance that was possible, right? The laws allowed for a very specific type of direct surveillance, and the technology was rather limited. There's only so much we could do. Now, thanks to the internet, and thanks to some poor decisions on the part of our governments, the laws are now much weaker, and the technology is much stronger. Thanks to the internet, it is now cheaper and easier than ever before to conduct mass surveillance on innocent citizens. And so, while the internet must be defended, while the values we hold so dear that make these stories possible in Canada and the United States must be protected, it must not be done at the cost of our security. And that is what the surveillance state is doing. And the internet is a fundamentally global democratic platform. And it must stay that way. It embodies all the values we as citizens in a democracy love. And we have not been good stewards of it. But now is the chance to change all that. And I hope you will work with me and Glenn to go against this motion. Thank you.
And I gotta say, Alexis, those shoes are killer. Professor Dershowitz, your opening statement, please.
Thank you very much. I know some of you may be wondering whether I'm on the right side of this debate. I've devoted my life to protecting privacy and civil liberties, yet I'm for this proposition. I am because I sincerely believe that surveillance, properly conducted and properly limited, can really and genuinely protect our liberties. Look, no state has ever survived without some surveillance, and no state deserves to survive if it has too much surveillance, particularly against its own citizens. A balance has to be struck, but that balance cannot eliminate the power of government to obtain information necessary to the defense of our freedoms. A proper balance requires a proper process for deciding when surveillance is justified, when the need for preventive intelligence is greater in any particular case than the need for privacy. And in striking that balance, it's important to distinguish among different types and degrees of surveillance. There's a considerable difference, for example, between street cameras that observe the external movements of people in public places and hidden microphones that can listen to what you're saying in your bedroom. There's a difference as well between accessing the content of phone calls and emails and cataloging the externalities of such messages, to whom they're sent, when they were sent. There's also a considerable difference between surveilling our own citizens and surveilling foreigners, including foreign leaders who are probably trying to listen in on our foreign, on our leaders' conversations. To fail to base our policies on this difference is to fail in the very act of governance, which requires nuance and calibration. Matters of degree matter, and differences in degree can differentiate pragmatic democracies who are genuinely seeking to protect their citizens against real harms from self-serving tyrannies that seek only to protect their leaders from accountability. We will hear tonight that terrorism and the need to protect our citizens is only a pretext, that there are other motives, sinister motives, for why we collect this information. So I will throw a challenge out to our distinguished opponents. What are those motives? Why would the Obama administration have continued this policy of surveillance after being briefed? Was it because President Obama has some sinister motive that he won't tell anybody about for gathering this information and is only using terrorism as a pretext, the way the Nazis in Germany used the Reichstag fire as a way of suppressing civil liberties? I don't believe that. I hope you won't either. Motives matter, though they too are difficult to discern and are frequently mixed. Many who supported the surveillance conducted by the FBI against the Ku Klux Klan and other racist groups during the civil rights movement opposed the very same surveillance techniques when they were used years later against the Black Panthers. And many who now applaud the decision to publish the illegally recorded private statements made by Donald Sterling to his mistress would express outrage if equally pernicious statements made in private by people they admire and respect were subject to public disclosure. Privacy for me, but not for thee, is as common as it is cynically self-serving. Now, we ought to be concerned about surveillance. There's virtually nothing that's immune from the pervasive eyes, ears, and even noses of the new generation of big brothers. It's absolutely true. But the most dangerous approach to our liberties is the all-or-nothing one proposed by radical proponents and opponents of all government surveillance. Those who oppose all surveillance are as dangerous to our liberties as those who uncritically support all surveillance. We need to know what harms our enemies, external and internal, are planning in order to prevent them from carrying them out. But we also need to impose constraints, and that's why process comes into play. We need a demanding process, but we need to make sure that the burden is realistically designed to strike a proper balance between two equally legitimate but competing values: the need for preventive intelligence to stop attacks against us and the need to protect our privacy from those who place too high a value on security and too low a value on privacy.
Thank you. blotter to atone for the sins of our fathers. Remote control destruction. We all got our hands on that button. Ghetto, we don't wanna know. It's the ultimate reality show. Defense of our glorious homeland. We'll draw a line of blood in the sand. But the only news that will reach us, stock footage and press releases. Nobody blown to pieces. No children blown to pieces. We filter our perception of reality through our dependency on primetime TV. Blood for oil, bodies for oil, power and oil. Blood for oil, 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 blood for oil.
Now for something completely different.